sahana bhavatu, sahanau punaktu, sahaviryam karavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Okay, Barbara has one question here, and then maybe we'll all have a question too, if you think it's okay. Let me answer this. Barbara's question is, what is the difference between I and I am? There really isn't any difference. One thing we have to make clear, though, is if you're saying the word I, you write I, or you write I am, those are only words pointing to you. Like say, sometimes I use the example, if you have a chair, the chair is an object that you're seeing, but the word chair is labeling the chair. There's a difference between the word chair and the chair. Right? The chair exists without the word chair, and I exist without the word I or I am. So in language, these words are just simply pointing to me. So when you say, what is the difference between I and I am, I'm taking it that you're talking about your actual self and not the words I and I am. And if that's so, then between I and I am, there is no difference, but why you might ask that question is that you are a conscious being. And so when I think of myself, I think of myself as a conscious being, not just an existent being. And so, if I understand that existence itself is consciousness and consciousness is existence, then I can say that I am is the I am conscious. There's no difference between the consciousness and existence. There's no difference between them. They're just pointing at two different words that are pointing to one thing. That's why, like for instance, when you say, I am, I exist, usually don't say, and I'm also conscious. Right? It's your being is a conscious being. And now, your being itself, just this me, the conscious being that you are, your existence, and your consciousness, both of those things have something important and common, and that is they can't be objectified. Like I can objectify this body and be aware of the body and all the qualities of the body and, you know, how old it is and what condition it's in, how it looks, all of these things. I can objectify my mind and my moods and my emotions and watch them change. I'm aware of them. I can describe them. You can't do that with consciousness. You can't say if I want to teach you about consciousness, I can't say, look, see this consciousness as though I'm holding an apple up or something. It's not something I can objectify. I can only use words to point your mind to the recognition of the conscious being that you are, but that you yourself can't look at as an object in a subject-object relationship. You simply are that. I am. If I say I am, I can't take that amness out and look at it. I don't need to take that amness or consciousness out and look at it because it's just self-evident. It's the bottom line. Which in Vedanta is the very important thing to understand, is that no matter what is going on in your body or your mind or in your perceptions, all of these perceptions, all of your feelings, all of your thoughts, all of those are continually changing, but they're continually changing in this the changeless base of yourself. In other words, I have this thought, then I have this thought, then I have this thought, then I have this thought. But all the way through all of these thoughts, I'm changelessly present. So this, here I am, this thought rises and sets, this thought comes, this thought comes, this thought comes. Nothing's happening to me. I'm the steady presence. It's the same in my emotional life. These feelings come, these feelings come, these feelings come, these feelings come. But I'm the stable one. I'm the one who's there throughout. changelessly. This is what this viveka, this discrimination, is what we don't have. We should have no discrimination there until it's pointed out. And when it's pointed out, they say, oh, well, yeah, of course. There's somebody, there's me present to all of my experiences. But until it's pointed out, I take myself to be one with those experiences. And so this viveka, this discrimination, is essential to Vedanta. But Vedanta has to help you to see. It's to recognize the one that no matter what is going on in the world of change that you experience, the one who is the self, the conscious being of all those experiences, is not changing. And when we do these types of meditations, we start often, there's 100 ways to do meditations, but one is to evoke that inner friend in yourself, the way you relate to all of your experiences. I call it the inner friend, because your buddhi, your mind, your intellect can take on that stance of being non-judgmental, non-critical, to be accepting, to be respectful, to respect yourself. Because we all have that part of ourself in our mind, in our intellect. But those qualities, which actually allow my mind and body to feel comfortable, to have a nice home, those qualities are actually the natural qualities of my being. Except the qualities, if I talk about them as qualities of my being, they're changeless qualities. Like this, your being is nonviolent, this me. It is by nature, you are by nature an inner friend. You are by nature non-judgmental. You are by nature accepting of what comes. And so it makes a big difference in your life if you can find that, recognize that part. Because if you recognize that part, there's always an inner sanctuary. There's a non-judgmental part that just allows, just accepts what's going on in a non-violent way, in an accepting way. And that self is changeless. And that self, the nature of that self, is the most personal to you. So when you say, I am, or me, you know, we're talking about this one who is present to all my experience. And so the I, the conscious being, and the I am, just to say I, or I am a conscious being, or I am, or I exist, or I am consciousness, all of these words are just pointers to your own sense of me. The problem with the words like I am, it's a capital I am, that type of thing, it's kind of esoteric or intellectual, and you think that you're supposed to find some big capital I am, or capital C, big consciousness, or something like that, which is not true. And that's why we have to deal with these words carefully. Because in the end, these words have to land on this personal self that you are, and you have to recognize them. You have to be able to differentiate that self from all the other experiences. Then you have a home base. And that home base can handle whatever your mind's going through or whatever the world's going through. Because that home base is not going through it. The home base is steady and simple and pure and non-judgmental. Okay? Okay, Belinda and Jacob, when you get a chance, I always appreciate how to manage the fact that there is so much suffering in the world. It seems that one can only feel peace when one blocks out the fact that being suffer, the knowledge of suffering is very heavy. Okay, well, let me talk about that. Okay, so whether you're a jnani or a mahatma, you know yourself and all of this, it does not mean that you're immune to the suffering of others or the suffering of other beings, the suffering of all of the animals, for instance, or all of the suffering that's going on, and if you're in any type of activist position, then you're continually having to deal with the pain that you feel in reference to all of these beings that are suffering, because you're involved in it and you can't totally block it out as though it's not there. And so you do feel it. You do feel that suffering, and you feel your own pain around it. But the Atma yourself is not suffering. That is the salvation to the whole thing. The self is not suffering. And so yourself is the same refuge, or the same whole, complete being to the illumination of illumining the suffering that you will feel when you're caring, when you care about people who are suffering, or you care about the earth that is suffering, or you care about the animals that are suffering, you suffer. And then you have to learn how to carry that suffering that you feel when you're aware of their suffering, because you care about them. So you will suffer. But the self is a sanctuary for that suffering. So even though they're suffering, there's someone who's not suffering. The self, which isn't suffering, is the refuge for the mind and the buddhi that is sharing the suffering of the people that you care about. In fact, I think you learn how to be with and accept those feelings, and to respect them. Because why shouldn't you feel something when some animals or beings or humans or whoever are suffering? Why shouldn't you feel something? I'm glad I feel something. I don't mind that I feel something. I think it makes us more human that we actually can feel something. It's also hard. It's hard to feel when there's not too much you can do to bring about the certain changes. So you do what you can do, and then you hold the suffering in a self that's not suffering. That's why that viveka, that discrimination between the freedom of your own being and your mind and your emotions, is so important. If I'm suffering because of the suffering of animals and things that really, really disturb me that are happening in the world, I don't take it as my suffering. I take it as Ishwara's suffering. Honestly, I do. I'm experiencing a suffering which is appropriate to the situation, and that suffering belongs to Ishwara. I don't think it's an individual suffering. I think it's a suffering that is evoked by the situation. And so I respect that type of a suffering. Now, another important thing, the differentiation between your own being, which is the sanctuary, which allows for that suffering, and your ability to not build up on the suffering. So say you have suffering, you're suffering, you feel the suffering of the animals or whatever. So you feel that suffering, you can accept that suffering and be with it as Ishwara. You don't want to be saying, you know, like, why is this happening? Why is this happening to me? And building up a whole web around it. That's what we call kind of the secondary suffering upon the suffering. What we really suffer from is not the suffering that's natural to Bhagavan, to Ishwara, but the Jiva Srishti. Means that your own Jiva Srishti means the Paribhasika, the individual projections onto the experience that you're having. And so if I'm not making a running commentary on the experience that I'm having, which one is of sadness or hurt for the plight, of animals or plants or the earth or other beings, then I think it is sacred. I think that suffering is sacred, and I don't mind holding it. If you start building up on it, then the jiva starts getting involved. Your individual person starts getting involved in making a really, casting a very tight web around it. And then I think it gets really difficult to handle. So I would just accept the suffering and be with it respectfully as Ishwara. I think the earth deserves some set our pain and suffering, and all the beings that are being treated as they are, all the living beings, how they're being treated. They're suffering. Why would we have some empathy for their suffering? I think it's the right thing. To build up the problem. And Swamiji will say, here's another thing that he says about this that I really like. You're aware of the suffering. You have empathy for it because you're a human being. And you haven't put blinders on, so you have empathy and you have feeling. Now you have to be objective. Now what can I do that is useful and helpful? Otherwise I can just kind of stir around in my own grief. But I can have that grief or sadness and then be objectively act upon the situation. And that's what Swamiji does, because I've seen his empathy many, many times for people who are suffering, toward animals, especially cows, who are suffering. I've seen the empathy, I've seen very deep feelings. That's Ishwara. Those feelings belong to Ishwara. As a human being, you should have those feelings. If we don't have feelings, I feel there's something the matter. That we've shut ourselves down. We're not available to have those feelings, or we've been conditioned in such a way as to have shut all of these things down. Otherwise we should be able to have feelings of empathy. You know what empathy means? It means that it's natural for you as a human being, and this is also why Dharma is something that doesn't really need to be taught. If you have empathy, it means you put yourself in the situation of the other. And that's natural human quality, to put yourself in the situation of another. And then to try to help. You understand the feelings of another, you have that empathy. We should have that empathy, at least for other humans, but we should have that empathy for all living beings, really. Even animals, you should put yourself in the situation of that animal. Is that how you want to be treated? All beings we should do that for. And then that's Dharma. It's inconvenient now in our culture. For hundreds of years it's inconvenient, and the whole culture has only reserved empathy. It has limited empathy. More empathy for your immediate friends and family. And less empathy the farther out you go. And what if you get to the animals, and then you get to the little animals, and then you get to the fish, you're going down the food chain, the empathy becomes less and less and less and less. You get to plants, for most people there's hardly any empathy at all, just plants, that's all.
So what's the solution there?
The solution is to contemplate on empathy, I guess. To care. We don't even know. At some point you start caring, you know. You care about others, you start wondering about the animals, you start wondering about the earth, you start wondering about the plants, like, you know, I was telling me about this interesting book on plants. You start to realize how intelligent they are. You start to become sensitive. Sometimes for me, Swamiji was such a huge role model for that sensitivity. He was so sensitive. He didn't just take the life of flowers. He would not take the life of a flower. Beautiful flower. Just imagine, it's walking down the pathway in India, you know, at the sun deepening there in India. He was walking down the pathway to the lecture hall. And it's lined with these plants, beautiful, beautiful flowers.
Jasmine.
All different ones. And he was walking by one, and he just very gently took it in his hand. And he just appreciated it so much, you know. And then he let it go. He just gently let it go. Gently took it, gently let it go. And then later he said, I would never pick a flower. Why would I take its life? It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful just being there, you know. Why would I rob it of its life? You know. He was taking a shower once. And his Kuteri went in to take a bath, and there were all these ants. So he was in that shower for a long time, cleaning out those ants. And now that can sound silly, because why don't you just put them down the drain? But what we think that, because that ant is little, and we're big. And so we don't have any empathy for that creature, because they're just a little speck, and we're a big giant. And since they were so big compared to they're so little, you don't have any empathy for their life, or their intelligence, or their family, all of these things. Sounds silly what I'm saying, like I'm a crazy person. But actually, these ants have all this intelligence, and they have all of this society, all of this stuff going on. They're teachers. There's a lot of study going on now about ants. You realize they're intelligent beings. But do we have empathy toward the ant? Probably not. Until you do. But you can go through life without any empathy and just turn on the tap and wash it down the drain. Without even thinking about it. Though you probably are thinking about it. You probably are, but it just flicks through. And you let it go. Until you don't. It's our task as human beings, because we have a choice to do these things.
You make us sound so barbaric.
Absolutely barbaric. I've spent my life becoming less and less barbaric. Here's one from Jagadish. To recognize and know I am Satyam, which is always free, is a maha blessing, but it seems not the whole truth. So is the next step to recognize and know I am the limitless whole. Okay, I understand the question. If you say I am Satyam, well, first of all, Satyam is an order of reality. It means that which exists in all three periods of time can never be negated. Satyam is the order of reality for Brahman. The Atma yourself. So if you were to say, I am Satyam, means I, myself, this being that I am, this conscious being, is the truth, is the reality, in that it never comes into being and goes out of being, it is absolutely stable and changeless. So the conscious being that you are, this me, is not something that is subject to time. And so we say, this me, if I go back, in terms of time in the universe, I go back thousands of years, millions of years, this me, as I am right now, not my thoughts, not the things that change, but my own presence, is here, as is, now, because timeless. So that is the reality of who I am. And as we start to understand this knowledge, we recognize that this whole universe, is, in fact, has this Satyam, this me, the conscious being, as its very, what we call adhishtana, as its very substance, its very reality. Now, to be a jnani, to be somebody who has self-knowledge, it's not enough to just recognize the changeless Sat-Chit conscious being. You need to recognize that this whole universe, including your body, mind, sense organs, everything about you, the body, mind, sense organs, and your situation and everybody else and everything in the whole infinite creation, everything without any exception on every level. It can go to heaven worlds and hell worlds, all different planes of existence, anything that exists within duality. This whole thing has for itself this one conscious being, for its truth. And so to really have knowledge, self-knowledge, is to realize that I am all of this. There's nothing here that is not me. And all of this that comes into being and goes out of being is what we call mitya. It has me for itself, itself not having any independent reality. Like, for instance, if I think of the ocean, for instance, all of the waves in the ocean, all of the waves belong to the ocean. They exist. All the waves together make up the ocean. But the truth of the ocean and the truth of all of the waves is one water. And so no matter what the size of the wave, it's still water. What the size of the foam, still water. The size of the whole ocean, still water. There's only one water there, in fact. You can't have a wave. Say, I want to have a wave, and I want to get rid of the water. You can't. You can get rid of the wave, but you can't get rid of the water. Right? The wave is totally dependent on the water. The ocean is totally dependent on the water. So I have to recognize, using that example, that all of this, all of these names and forms that are coming into being and going out of being, are nothing but the water of myself, conscious being. And so to be somebody who has self-knowledge is not enough to just resolve into conscious being. I have to know that all of this is nothing but conscious being. And so that's your question, I'm sure, Jagadish. It's like, if you just say, I am Satyam, you can go just into the truth of your own being. But then you should be able to be with the truth of your own being with your eyes open or closed, with or without a thought, with or without an emotion. The emotions and thoughts and feelings and perceptions are what we call mitya. Mitya means it's an order of reality. They depend upon your being for their existence, like the waves all depend upon the water. They have no being without the water, and all of these experiences you have no substance at all without your being. Your being's not dependent on them, but they're totally dependent upon you. And so that's the knowledge. You have to recognize I am all of this.
But do you have that as like a physical experience that says this is Ishwara and I am part of Ishwara and I can identify all of this as his body and have a sense of spirituality about it all?
The problem that what gets in your way, I think, before that is that your sense of touch in the physical body, when you get knowledge, is not going to spread out to the whole universe.
No.
Right? Your sense of the five sense organs that you have continue to function as your own limited sense organs. Say you gain knowledge and realize that all of this is your being. It's not all of a sudden your eyes are able to see the whole thing. Or that your sense of touch is able to feel both. The body, mind, sense organs that you are, with your mind, continues to have the same limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But what you've recognized directly and immediately is, first of all, the changelessness of your own being. It can't be this me that I am. It can't be objectified by any of us. That means it can't be two. Because anything that in any kind of dual relationship, it has to be objectifiable. Like, I'm different than you. What I'm saying is my body's different from your body. And I can objectify my body and I can objectify your body. And they're different from each other, or we accept that. But consciousness is not an object in time and space. So as I start to understand, I recognize that this me that is definitely experiential as my own self, not as an object, but as my own being, can't be two. I have to be able to understand that logically and experientially. In all ways, I can understand that. Then, I also understand logically, as well as experientially, that just like I objectify all of you, I can see you, I can see you, I can see you, I can also see this body. Right? You have thoughts, I know, because you tell me about your thoughts and I can see them, you know, as they kind of morph into your body, your frowns and worries and whatever we do. But I'm also aware of my thoughts. Everything that I used to identify with as me is actually something that is objectified. Just like this whole room is objectified. Right? This body is objectified as part of this room.
Okay.
The thoughts are objectified. The feelings are objectified. The I thought is objectified. So this whole world is in a way like a dream. When you have a dream, you take a dream body in the dream. The dream body belongs to the dream, right? The whole dream exists in you. You're the self of the whole dream. And so, even though the difference between the dream and my situation here is that I've woken up from the dream, and I can say, ah, that dream character in that dream was just part of the dream. It's going to be harder for that dream character in the dream to recognize that he's only part of the dream or she's only part of the dream, and the whole dream enjoys me, is myself. The dream comes from me, is sustained by me, goes back into me. It's easy for me, the waker, to recognize the truth of that, what the dreamer experiences. Now here I am in the waking state, with this body, within this creation. So say now, this is the waking state dream, as though the dream, this world, is like the dream, and I am a dream character in this world, as though. And now I have to recognize that this body, mind, sense organs really is part and parcel of a much larger me, which we call Ishwara, the one from whom this whole creation, I am the self from whom this whole creation comes, is sustained, and resolves into. I understand that through many, many avenues of both the logic, experience backed by logic. But if you're looking to be Ishwara, this upadhi is not going to be Ishwara. This upadhi is going to be part of Ishwara, like the wave is going to be part of the ocean. Right? The wave can say, from the standpoint of my body, O ocean, I am part of you. But from the standpoint of myself, I am you. So I realize through logic-backed experience, right, that this body, mind, sense organs belongs to Ishwara, and that Ishwara is nothing but myself in truth.
Well, you get a sense of relief if you know that this body is not yourself and belongs to Ishwara. Is there
Well, the body is yourself, though, right?
Yes, it
but
is.
But yourself is free from the body, but the body is yourself. The creation is yourself, but free from this, from yourself. But yourself is free from it.
So is there kind of an emotional sense of oneness? Or?
I'll tell you what stops that.
Yeah.
Whenever there's a lack of vairagya, means I want this. Vairagya means I want this so I can be happy. Or I don't want this so that I can be happy. Whenever that's there, now you have entered as a jiva into the world.
Yeah.
When that vairagya is there, vairagya means I'm not requiring the world to make me happy. And even if you're an ajnani, it means you have no self-knowledge. There's many times, moments, you're taking a walk in nature or whatever, where you're not wanting anything to be different. At that time you have, it's like a spiritual experience. Right, you experience oneness, you experience a presence, you experience yourself being part of something. It's only when ignorance-born, raga, dvesha, those likes and dislikes come, on all kinds of subtle levels, I need this and I need that, in order to be happy, to be whole, you know, that goes away.
Yeah.
And so as your knowledge gets more integrated and gets into those problematic areas that are so kind of sensitive, like I really do need this, whatever. I know the truth and everything, but I really do need this.
Yeah.
Okay. Bhagavan should give me this. I need this. That has to go. And you can't just make it go. It has to go with understanding, with time. You outgrow these things. Like vairagya, vairagya is knowledge. You grow into your knowledge, and as you grow into your knowledge, the vairagya becomes more and more. Because you actually don't need any of these things. You think you do, but you don't. It's kind of, they're addictions. Yeah, it's really, food addictions are big.
What?
It's good, I mean, for some of us, to really understand the power of addiction. You know, like say you're addicted to having a certain, like coffee every morning, you know, you're addicted to having kombucha or something, you know. And you really, you crave it, you really want that. And like your life kind of depends on it. It's what makes your life nice, or to have your ice cream at night, or whatever. It's something that you really need that, you want that, you don't want to give that up. But it's also not good for you. And so when you finally do give it up, it only takes like 2 or 3 days for the sugar addiction to go away. You do give it up, you don't miss it at all. Nothing. So our addictions to things, we have addictions to things. You know, all kinds of addictions. And we think they have something to do with our happiness. But when you get rid of them, they're gone. The addiction is broken. They have nothing to do with your happiness. You don't even miss them. It's really
bizarre.
It's bizarre. But these addictions, these raga dveshas, cause a lot of stress in life. They're not easy. That's the whole problem. But you can't be free of the raga dvesha, these passions. I need this. I have to have this to be happy. Da 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 da. You can't give those up unless you yourself have discovered the source of happiness. Because you have to be happy, because that's your nature. That ananda, that wholeness, is your nature. And until you've discovered it, it's being projected out everywhere. And it's like telling somebody, you don't need to be happy. Give it up.
Yeah. So when you spot this, then the idea is to review the source of well-being, or
yeah. Well, there's all kinds of things you have to talk to whatever is age appropriate. Like if there's little ones inside, they have to be taken care of. But in terms of your raga dvesha, as an adult part of you,
yeah,
is to bring your knowledge back in. So to put things in proper context based on your knowledge. And that just becomes that shouldn't be a big deal, it's just an easy thing to do. You know? Don't make it into a big thing.
Yeah. Right.
Or even worry about some tenacious desire you have. Just, that's inner child work then. If you have a really tenacious desire that is causing you pain, you know, then you have to talk to the little ones inside. Because otherwise you can be able to calm down. You go for that desire. If it's not adharmic, does it go against, you know, at your ethics or your morals? And just don't go after that desire, and I'll take the results as prasad from Bhagavan. There's so many ways, attitudes that you can have to let yourself really take care of your passions and desires in the world in a way that you still remain whole and complete inside. It also doesn't work to say, I really want that, but I'm not going to do it. So if you really want it, then go ahead and do it, but then have an attitude about it and that allows you to fully invest yourself in it and at the same time be free by having that relationship with Ishwara. And it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of nuance to that, but it's okay. Anything else?
Just to ask. I hear the word spiritual being used by all kinds of people of all different religions or non-religions. You fill out a form and check your religion, Christian, Hindu, this, and then there's always a check mark for spiritual but not religious. And I've heard this evening you use the word spiritual, and Edward used the word spiritual, and
I use it for you.
so did I.
And I would just like, I mean, I don't really expect to get any, you know, any great big clarity on this, but I'm just curious as to, I'm confused about that word.
Yeah, probably rightly so also. Nella's question is, what about the word spiritual? It's used in so many different ways by so many different people, and what does it mean? And well, just for starters, when I teach my non-dual perspectives in spiritual and spiritual counseling at a class at CIS, one of the first things I do in the first class is have everybody write out what they mean by non-dual. Because non-dual is a buzzword. I'm saying this because spiritual is also a buzzword. And so they write out what they mean by non-dual. And then we all read and share, you know. And they're all different, you know. And so, but they're different, but there's some certain things that are the same, even though they're different. There's a feel to it that is the same. And I think that probably that's true with the word spiritual, but what we decide to point out is interesting. Like, if you're asking me, so I'm looking, well, what would I point out for that? And what I would, as you said also, I would differentiate spiritual from religion, because religion is dogma-based. Like, the Jews believe certain things, the Christians believe certain things, the Hindus believe, the Buddhists, the Muslims, they all have different dogmas. You know, the way that they're talking about God. But what the spiritual would be, perhaps the recognition that there is something greater than yourself that you relate yourself to. I think that would be an important aspect. And if we go away from the different dogmas and doctrines to the mystical side of every religion, then that would be more spiritual to me, because what would be spiritual is the desire for a direct, immediate relationship with God. Whatever that God is going to be, you know, that which is greater than yourself, it's not good enough for that God to just be out there somewhere. You want a real relationship or union. And Vedanta would be, that union would be the, in terms of that identity, that oneness, you know. And so a spiritual person would be somebody who, recognizing their part of something greater, and then all recognizing being part of something greater, then that also becomes something that is a guiding principle in their life. It's not just something that they write off, is something that's really important, and that's a spiritual person. Then Dharma and all of these things come into that, because you start to recognize the laws of the creation, the laws of that something greater of which you are a part. And I think that Dharma and Adharma and all of these things then become very very real. And also I think that there's much more often, but not need be, but all, much more of an understanding of a reincarnation or life after death, or the purpose of life having to do more with union with God.
So your conversations at CIS conclude in this format after they
No, I was just using that as an example for non-dual. Now I'm just talking about, because Nella asked, and I'm saying, this is what I would say. What would you say?
It just seems like you say, it's such a buzz, we don't know what people mean by it, or I'm afraid to use the word, and then...
But we're trained that way. We're afraid to use any word. You know.
Yeah.
Without defining it, you know.
Yeah.
We can't.
Yeah.
You know, so,
yeah. Because we know. If it hasn't been defined for me, I don't want to use it.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
If what?
If it hasn't been defined or you don't define the word, you can't really use it because everybody is dealing with that word differently.
Yeah.
You know, and spiritual would be a good example of that. But so many words are like that. Even a person is religious, or they're dharmic or adharmic, or they're, or even words like non-duality, consciousness, existence, all of these words.
Awesome.
All of these words have different meanings. So, a whole of Vedanta, everything has to be.
When you started saying something greater than yourself, I mean, I don't need to go to the spiritual realm to find things that are greater than myself.
Yeah, that's why when I say greater than, then I have to unfold what I mean by that.
Yeah.
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 Thank
yes.
you.
Yeah, you're welcome. But something which is greater than yourself would include you.
Yeah,
in which you're included.
Including you is the important part there.
Yeah.
I mean.
Uh-huh. Okay. I like that. That's good. Mm. I feel like the word has gotten a little respectability from me.
So you should start using it.
Well, I still can't. I mean, I just don't know if I can use it with random people who have random metaphysical assumptions.
It's just table talk.
Yeah.
I don't ever do it.
Yeah.
Or I feel kind of bored inside.
Uh-huh.
Because we're not really talking.
Right. I guess that's what it is that it just never lands on anything for me, and I don't know what... And everybody seems to give it so much respect, this word. And so I feel like I should come to grips with it somehow.
You can ask, what do you mean by spiritual? So many people use that word. What do you mean by it? That's what I do to my students all the time. But it gets them thinking, because there are so many spiritual buzzwords.
Spiritual counseling?
We have to define that too.
Didn't Swamiji once say you didn't?
I've always said that too. Divine kind of creeps me out, but it doesn't everybody. Some people, that word really resonates with them, the divine. For some reason, I don't know if it has Christian overtones or something for me, but it doesn't resonate with me. Divine.
Well, it's etymologically like deva, right? Divine.
Yeah, it should be like deva. It comes from the root div.
Yeah.
To div means to light up, to be luminous. Div is a Sanskrit root, and deva comes from that. So divine would come from deva. That's nice. I never thought of that. But that's obvious. There's a few cognates, not very many. But their cognates were important words like bratra is brother, matra is mother, pitra is father, that pa is pha. The pa has become pha in the linguistically.
The one that knocks me out that has so many cognates is sta.
For stand.
Stand, standard, stalwart.
Yeah, sta, that's right. Steady, sta.
Dozens and dozens of words.
That's right.
Stana?
Sta, stanam is a Sanskrit.
Yeah.
But say stand in English. Stand, standard, stalwart. Because stand is, sta means stand, firmness, steadiness,
solid.
Yeah, solid, yeah.
Not shaky.
Yeah. Let me see here. David and Jackie. Swamiji talks about Sakshi, the witness, in his Advaita Makaranda series. Is the Sakshi identical with Atman? Okay, that's... Hang on a second. The Sakshi, we use the word Sakshi to take the mind step by step in Drikdrisha Viveka, the seer seeing differentiation. We take the mind step by step to the recognition of what we call the Pratyek Atma, that innermost self, having objectified everything else. But now, the problem is in the seer, in this teaching methodology of seer seeing, if I objectify the body, then the seer of the body becomes my sense organs, right? How is this body known? It's through my sense organs. So my sense organs is the seer. Now, if I objectify these sense organs, the mind becomes the seer, right? This mind is aware of the sense organs. Now, say I objectify the mind, I can go to the buddhi. The intellect is the one who is aware of the fluctuating mind, the emotions, all of that. I can even objectify, so the buddhi becomes the knower of the manas, of the mind. Now, I get to something now where the mind itself, or the buddhi itself, is objectified. Now, who is objectifying that? Because the buddhi is known, the intellect is known. So who's the knower? Who's the seer? We say the Atma. It goes through the Atma as the Sakshi. The Atma is the witness of all of that. And so now we have the Atma is equated to the Sakshi, the witness, which now makes the Atma a seer, right? And so now what's happened is with the Driktrishi Viveka, you get all the way to the Atma, but the Atma still at this point as the Sakshi, it's labeled the Sakshi because it is the conscious being because of which the mind is known. So that's why we call it the Sakshi. But now, in order for the Driktrisha Viveka to be complete, we have to go into the nature of that Sakshi, the Atma. And see, is the Sakshi, is the Atma, which we're now calling the Sakshi, the witness, in reference to the buddhi, the intellect, is it actually performing a function of witnessing? And so now what we do, now that we're here at the with the self that's now been called the Sakshi, we now go back and we remove all of the objects, all of the things that have been objectified from the Atma. So we remove the body, just hypothetically, you remove the body because it's been objectified, so it's differentiated from the Atma. We remove the sense organs, we remove the mind, we remove the intellect, we remove the ahankara. Anything that we've been able to objectify, we remove that from the Atma.
So they're all gone.
They're all gone. Because they are all gone in the sense that they're objectified, so they're not, they don't have the nature of whatever is objectifying them. But once you get rid of all of these things, you can objectify space itself. With what instruments is the Atma allowed to be a seer? Because the mind is gone, the sense organs are gone, the buddhi is gone, time and space are gone, everything is gone. And so then what we realize is the Atma is, we only use Sakshi heuristically in order to get to the self from the standpoint of the buddhi.
Okay, heuristically?
But it's a teaching methodology. And so once we get to the Atma and we look at it from its own standpoint, then we say it's just conscious being. It's like we don't say the sun. The sun is a light, a fireball. That fireball illumines the world. Anything in its wake, it illumines. But it's not performing an act. But let me illumine that. Let me illumine that. Anything that is in its presence is illumined because of the nature of the sun. So like that, the Atma, anything that is known not because the self is performing a function of knowing it, but because the self itself is the conscious being that's the knownness, the self-evident knownness, that is illumining all of those vrittis, those thought modifications.
So it's
not performing a function of being a knower. It's the very knowledge or consciousness because of which things are known, but it's not performing a function of knowing. And so in this teaching methodology of the Driktrisha Viveka, part of that methodology has to do with the resolution of the Sakshi into the consciousness of the Atma.
So consciousness itself, it's, it's effulgent, but it's not a, it's not witnessing if
yeah, it's not performing any function of witnessing.
It's like ever present.
It's ever present consciousness, but it's not a knower. All these things are known,
yeah.
But it itself is not knowing them. It is the consciousness which illumines them, but it's not knowing them.
But it's called a witness when, in what circumstances?
It's only in this drik drisha where we're breaking everything down in your experience to see your seeing. We get to the atma as being the consciousness which illumines the mind. And so initially that's called the sakshi. But from its own standpoint, it's not a sakshi. It's just consciousness.
Okay.
I could use sakshi all the way through. I could say the sakshi of the body are the sense organs. The sakshi of the sense organs is the mind. The sakshi of the mind is the buddhi. The sakshi of the buddhi is the atma. But we usually just use sakshi at the end for the atma.
Because in the Thousand Names of Vishnu, they say Vishnu is the witness, the sakshi.
As pure consciousness. That's why these words have to be understood.
Yeah.
From the standpoint of the creation, Brahman is the sakshi. But from the standpoint Oh yeah, good, right. Okay, everybody.
Good.
We call it a night. Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalintam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmane Pyashubamastu Nityam Lokasamasta Sukhino Pavantu Kali Varshatu Parjanyaha Prativi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamcho Parahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukkha Bhag Bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotir kamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, om purnamadath purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate, purnasya purnamadaya purnamevavasishyate, Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om